Hi, my name is Amy Gower and I'm a historian at the University of Reading. My research looks at secondary schooling in the late 20th and early 21st centuries, so from around 1970 to 2005. And I'm particularly interested in how changing attitudes towards gender and sexuality affected the experiences of teenage girls, how they constructed their identities, and how they planned for their futures. Stereotyped ideas of men and women's roles and characteristics, so the idea that men were naturally breadwinners and leaders and women were more suited to a domestic role, were quite prevalent at the start of the 70s. And this distinction of men and women's roles within this institution of heterosexual marriage also excluded lesbian, gay and bisexual people who were often seen as outside of this social norm. And schooling in the late 20th century reflected these gendered roles. Schools aimed to prepare pupils for their futures as adults with these distinct roles within the family. So my research looks at how teachers challenged these rigid ideas of gender and how feminism might have influenced these changes. So firstly, teachers and local education authorities tried to equalise the subjects and topics offered in school by the formal curriculum. So it wasn't unusual in the early 1970s for schools to offer different subjects for girls and boys, such as cooking and needlework and childcare for girls, subjects that would prepare for them for this domestic role. After the 1975 Sex Discrimination Act, though, schools had a legal responsibility to make sure that pupils had equal access to all topics and subjects. But in practice, often pupils continued to make sex stereotype choices here. So girls still predominantly chose to do things like cooking and sewing. So clearly there was some kind of social or cultural aspect here which informed how girls and boys made these sorts of decisions. So I'm really interested in what happens as a result of these limits. And what we see from around the early 1980s is that feminist teachers made attempts to tackle something called the hidden curriculum, which refers to the more subtle ways that gender difference was reinforced in schools. And this hidden curriculum could be things like boys talking over girls in the classroom and dominating discussions, or by only showing photos of boys in physics textbooks or in displays. Some teachers try to make masculine subjects more appealing to girls and vice versa. So for example, trying to adapt child development to cater towards boys' interests and learning styles. Whilst these changes weren't completely universal across all schools, they signal a more critical approach among school staff and education providers to these rigid boundaries of gender roles throughout the 1970s and the 1980s. The gender stereotyping that we see in schools obviously had an impact on pupils. So girls who did manage to gain places in previously male-dominated subjects could face harassment, and some felt that they even had to work harder than boys to prove that they belonged in these sorts of spaces. And vice versa, boys who expressed interest in more feminine subjects could also face ridicule. However, after 1988, girls did begin to perform better than boys in their exams, and more girls than ever took up places at university. And changes brought about by feminist educators to the curriculum, for example, including women's history topics on things like witchcraft, were remembered really fondly by some of the pupils that I've interviewed in my research. So schooling could then be a way for some pupils to subvert the expectations of their gender and pursue non-traditional subjects and paths. But the emphasis on exam results as a way of improving girls' opportunities also had its problems. Girls who gained fewer qualifications at school than their peers still often faced gender stereotype choices when leaving school. For example, being advised by their teachers to pursue things like office work or childcare. So while schooling was somewhat successful in adapting to more flexible ideas of men and women's roles, when it came to sexuality, the idea of the nuclear family was still a really powerful symbol. Sex education was highly restricted throughout the late 20th century. In some areas, like one of the areas that I research in London, schools attempted to give advice on relationships and contraception, which emphasised pupils' choice. In Inner London, there was this understanding among people who were designing sex education that there was an important difference between children and teenagers, and perhaps that teenagers would be capable of making some of their own decisions. However, this then comes into tension with this other idea that school children are inherently innocent and therefore vulnerable to being morally corrupted by learning about things like sex and sexuality that are seen as more adult things. A series of government acts in the early 90s were informed by these ideas and restricted sex education to be about within the boundaries of family life. So in other words, reinforcing the idea that sex should only take place between a married heterosexual couple. So if sex education for heterosexual teenagers was restricted, then it was even more so for gay, lesbian and bisexual teenagers. In 1988, Section 28 of the Local Government Act banned teachers from intentionally promoting homosexuality in schools. So this kind of contributed to a climate of secrecy around sexualities. And we need to consider what this might have meant for pupils who, as a result, had very little access to information or support or positive representations of LGBT people. Schooling in some ways eroded this ideal of the heterosexual nuclear family with distinct gender roles and allowed some girls and boys to step outside of these norms. However, sex education continued to reinforce heterosexuality in marriage, which often prompted teenagers to seek out information for themselves. There are lots of official documents that we can look at to find out about the curriculum and what happened within schools. So, for example, inspectors' reports of individual schools and the records of local education authorities, which is what I do to find out about Inner London. And these can kind of show us at a local level what subjects are taught and to what pupils and what local authorities and schools were doing to counteract inequalities. But also, whenever we think about these sort of historical questions, it's really important to think about the experiences of the people who attended school. And these can sometimes be a bit trickier to find. Whilst nearly all people have attended school at some point in their childhoods, not everybody keeps the sort of written records of their childhood, things like diaries, letters, notes, school books, things like that. And they can be quite difficult to find, but provide really, really important insights into people's experiences. Also using things like oral histories, so interviewing people about their school days, can be really fruitful, both in providing information and hearing about their experiences firsthand, but can also mean that the sorts of written records, which they might not think are important, things that get left up in a box in the attic, for example, can be gathered. And we might also want to look at some sort of published sources as well, where pupils have made their marks, such as advice columns of magazines, or published collections of things like children's poetry. So now we're going to look at this advert from the Telegraph newspaper in 1977 for Cheltenham and Gloucester Building Society. This advert's aimed at parents of 10-year-old-ish girls and promotes savings accounts. When we approach sources like this, it's quite important to think about audience as well as what the source is actually telling us. And it tells us a few really important things. Firstly, about gendered life cycles, then about sexual knowledge, and something about class as well. Firstly, it tells us about the expected life stages for girls. So the advert suggests that girls go from playing with dolls as a child to being a beautiful 20-year-old preparing for marriage. Pupils would leave school sometime between ages 16 and 18, like they do now. So this idea of being married at 20 means that there's quite a small gap of a couple of years where it was expected girls would be working a bit, dating, but ultimately also living with her parents before becoming a wife and leaving home. There's also some suggestions here about knowledge of puberty, reproduction, and sexuality. The girl is shown as entering a distinct stage of development once she knows about the facts of life, which is kind of a phrase used for sex, something which she will need to know later on when she marries at age 20. And the suggestion as well that she needs to learn how to be a prudent saver also reflects ideas of women's domestic role, balancing a household budget so she can set up her own house. There are also undertones with this language of saving about girls' virtue and sexuality as well, that perhaps girls should be saving both their money and their virtue for marriage. This source also tells us something about class and gender. The girl pictured is wearing a boater hat and a school uniform that's much more reminiscent of a public school education, one where parents would pay fees rather than a free state education. The advert clearly then is targeting middle and upper class parents, parents who could afford to save money and own a home. The male breadwinner, female homemaker model that we talked about earlier is also quite a class model. Working class women have always had to take up some form of paid employment to support their families. What's also interesting is that this advert appeared in the feminist magazine Spare Rib as an example of sexism in advertising. It also shows us that these ideas of gender were challenged in the 1970s and 80s and were not universally accepted. So this second source is an extract from Jenny Lives with Eric and Martin, which was a book published in English in 1983, which shows the day-to-day life of a six-year-old girl, Jenny, her dad Martin, and his boyfriend Eric. It was quite controversial at the time and sparked a lot of political and press debate about its suitability for children, primarily because it showed a loving relationship between two men who were raising a child together, something which challenged the established norm of heterosexual marriage, which I mentioned earlier on. This particular extract is useful for historians because it leads us to think not just about what was in the book, the content, but also its purpose and how it was used in schools. So Jenny Lives with Eric and Martin was available in libraries in inner London, but because of the controversy surrounding it, it was limited to use in exceptional circumstances. It was recommended for use by a teacher with a child in a sort of one-to-one setting, perhaps with a child who might benefit from reading it, for example, someone who was being raised by gay parents. In this extract, Eric and Martin reassure Jenny after an encounter with a neighbour who is openly hostile to seeing two men sharing their affection in public. In the 1980s, such encounters and worse were quite widespread occurrences. Eric and Martin tell Jenny that some people are hostile because they're frightened of what they don't know or just don't understand. Pupils might have encountered such hostility in public spaces themselves or with their families. Therefore, the book tries to reassure the reader that the fault is not with them or with their families, but with ignorant or unkind people. So whilst this is undoubtedly a positive measure, which was aimed to support children of gay parents, the fact that this was not more widely available to pupils suggests that homosexuality was still seen as something which should be kept hidden. Fears around such literature suggested pupils might be confused by it or easily led, echoing this idea that sexual knowledge would lead young people into morally risky behaviour. So thinking about not just what these sources say, but their audience and their purpose reveal a few important things. Source one reveals that the idea of a normal life course for girls, which resulted in marriage at a young age, was a powerful and pervasive image, whilst source two shows us that representations of non-traditional families were available to young people, although they were sometimes restricted in their use and how many young people could actually access them. Bringing them together reveals that whilst heterosexual marriage was still a powerful tool used in education to determine the gender roles of girls and boys, and to marginalise sexualities, this was far from universal. These sources show us that this established social order was a challenge throughout the 70s and beyond, opening up new possibilities for pupils to step outside of the boundaries of traditional norms of gender and sexuality.